One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So the topic of tonight's event is war and peace in the Middle East. Helen and I were just going through this earlier. Since October the 7th, we've done 10 episodes in total on the Middle East, from Israel, Gaza, to Iran, to Turkey, to the Red Sea. And then this morning, we recorded our first episode on ISIS. Quite a grisly subject, but I think it was really, really interesting. So that's out tomorrow. So there's obviously a huge amount to talk about in terms of war and peace. So what we thought we'd do tonight is to think about the biggest picture that we could. So sort of draw the camera back as far as we could, just try and think about why there is so much war and so little peace in the region. And we thought that the best place to start was with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War, and this kind of creating the conditions that we still have today.
Yeah, when we were talking about how we could do this, I think we kept coming back to this idea that we've talked about between ourselves a number of times, and I've spent a reasonable amount of time thinking about in the last few years, which is how to frame the Middle East through the lens of overall 20th century history. And I think that if we do that and we go back to the First World War, as Tom said, we can see something that's really quite important, but I think is often overlooked. And that is that in the end, the First World War became a contest geopolitically, because obviously there are many other things going on, for control of the Ottoman Empire. I don't believe that that was the cause of the First World War. But if you then said, what was the geopolitical prize at stake as the war developed in the way in which it did and the powers aligned in the way in which that they did and the territory that was being fought over, what changed was who controlled the, by the end of the war, defunct Ottoman territory. And that principally meant the Middle Eastern territory in the Ottoman Empire, because the European part of the Ottoman Empire had been lost in the Balkans in particular, obviously it had been lost in the preceding years. So if we start from that idea, we can say two things, I think. First of all, why was it so important? And I think the answer is that in the beginning of the 20th century, oil was discovered in the Middle East. It was discovered in Persia, in the southern part of Persia, which was a British sphere of influence, but there was already considerable confidence that there was also going to be oil in Mesopotamia, so present-day Iraq. And really, I think you could say that the British and the Germans in particular were in a contest for control over the Mesopotamian part of the Ottoman Empire from the beginning of the 20th century, conceivably even before. And then that conflict came to a head through the First World War. And the British, allied to the French, ended up on the winning side, including taking control of Baghdad 1917 and Mosul in November of 1918. And the Germans, despite having aligned with the Ottomans precisely for this reason, ended up on the losing side. And that what we then see is a situation in which, in a world in which empire was already becoming actually quite difficult for European powers, that we have new imperial projects in the Middle East. That isn't to say that Britain hadn't acted like an imperial power, been an imperial power in a number of ways in the Middle East prior to the First World War, but it was kind of centered on Egypt and to some extent what was later going to become Aden. But otherwise, it had operated around the sphere of influence in Persia and a protectorate, as I say, in Egypt itself. But in the 1920s, so after the First World War, it was actually going to try to govern these places where oil was. And right from the start, was going to have an incredibly difficult time doing it, because one of the reasons why the Ottoman Empire had come to an end during the course of the First World War was Arab nationalism, something that had actually been encouraged by the British, obviously. Think of like Lawrence of Arabia. But the British started trying to be an imperial power in this part of the world, in which they already had to make concessions to the Iraqis even before they'd actually taken control of Mesopotamia as part of the mandate that they'd been awarded by the League of Nations. I say be awarded, but they'd basically won as a result of their military power. So in that sense, the Middle East becomes a region that is late to the experience of European empire, yet at the same time, the resource that's there is the most important resource of the 20th century.
When do you think that then happens? Because you've mentioned this moment in 1915, isn't it, where suddenly British control of the Suez Canal is threatened. But that's not a fear about oil, that's a fear about our empire in India, effectively, rather than what has been discovered. So when does that shift?
Well, I think that what's true there, Tom, is that it goes, that both of these stories are coming together at this point. So I think we've talked about in this one of the episodes, when we talked in the episode we did on Britain and Israel, in the fact that the British have the fear of God, so to speak, put into them in 1915, when they realise that the Ottomans and the Germans in this war are coming up through the Sinai Desert to attack Suez that way. And on the one hand, they're clearly terrified because, as you said, Suez is the passage to India. But also, Suez Canal is the passage for taking Iranian oil, or Persian oil as it still then is, into Britain. So that you've got the old reason for empire in the Middle East bound up with the Suez Canal and India, and the new reason for empire in the Middle East, or the, at that point, the aspiration to empire in the Middle East, bound up with oil.
Yeah, it's not a sort of formal empire in this sense, but it's the beginning, I think, of this story that we're going to try and tell tonight, of outside powers trying to assert some kind of control of the Middle East, but ever since the Ottoman Empire has collapsed, never being able to. No power since then has been able to assert some kind of hegemonic control. And that is a kind of core reason why we have continual crisis there.
Yeah, I think that if you think about it as the British and the French story, what you can see is that they find the business of being imperial powers in Mesopotamia, in Syria, and in Palestine, in the case of Britain, incredibly difficult through the 1920s and the 1930s. Even if you think about it in terms of what they are in significant part, therefore, the oil part of it, even that they find really quite difficult. It's only in 1927 that actually this oil in Mesopotamia is actually found. And then by the time you get to the 1930s, when there's a reasonable prospect that the best oil in the region lies in Saudi Arabia, it's actually an American company. Thanks in part to Kim Philby's father, I think, as we've talked about in one of the episodes, that establishes itself there. The British never really get to grips with how they're going to deal with what's going on in Palestine between the Arab community and Jewish migration. And effectively, having given that promise of the Balfour declaration, so to create a Jewish homeland back in 1917, and that being part of the mandate for Palestine, they're repudiating the policy in 1939, I think.
Yeah, they're starting to repudiate it during the war, and then you see Attlee pulling back from it very quickly after the war. But then again, you've got this story of kind of Western weakness or imperial weakness. In Britain, is unable to assert its control in this period, 45 to 47. And I think this is an important moment in this wider story. Then you get British kind of withdrawal in this period, both in Palestine to begin with, they're sort of effectively handing over the problem to the UN. Then in that having knock-on effect in Egypt, or sort of withdrawing to Egypt, obviously withdrawing from India as well. And then in 47, you get this kind of momentous moment where we declare we can't do the job in Greece either, or in Turkey. And this is the moment that creates the Truman Doctrine, which kind of sets up a lot of the world that we're familiar with. And the Truman Doctrine is, right, okay, we've got a problem. The Brits are going to pull out of Greece. Do we let Greece fall to the Soviet Union or not? And Turkey. And then the Truman Doctrine is the Americans will support democratic powers from falling to communism. But it's not just democratic powers, is it? And this is what you sort of, you pointed out to me, really. I'm sort of almost accepting that at face value, but it's that Truman Doctrine applies to Greece and to Turkey. And it's from that moment that the Americans become a European power, which I think is fundamentally important. In that, in a sense, the sort of weirdly, in the conditions that exist in the Middle East, I guess you could see some parallels in Europe in that you had collapses of empire in Europe after the First World War that weren't stable without a sort of hegemonic power asserting authority in Europe. And that's not resolved until after the Second World War. And it's America that asserts its power through NATO. I'm working on a book about the long history of Brexit at the moment. And that seems it's such an important moment because at the same time that that's happening, that the Americans are asserting their power, they're also bailing out the European economies through the Marshall Aid. And one of the conditions of Marshall Aid is that Europe has to unite. You have to get your house in order, effectively, if we're going to give you this amount of money and we're going to defend you. And so the condition is you have to come together. And so at the same moment that that's happening, you have the Schuman Declaration, which is the beginning of the European project that presents Britain with a problem. So you've got a kind of hegemonic power in Europe, but you don't have one in the Middle East. And that is never asserted. And then we can sort of tell that story up until Suez, in a way, Suez in 56.
Yeah, I think that there's a point as well in which these stories really intersect with each other, because one of the conditions of martial aid, or the effective conditions of martial aid, is that the dollars are used to buy oil from American oil companies in the Middle East, so the heirs to Standard Oil. So these two things are connected in that respect. So the Americans effectively say, we are going to act as a military power and organize you into military alliance for NATO in Western Europe. We're not going to act as a military power in the Middle East. We're going to have Britain carrying on as an imperial power in the Middle East in order to protect Western European energy security there. And what does that in part translate into? It translates into buying oil from the American oil companies, because remember, this is not a period of time when the Arab states, or indeed Iran, is controlling oil themselves. And the reason why Turkey has to be part of NATO, which is obviously quite awkward in West European terms, think of it as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is because the Americans need to make sure that the Soviets are not going to come into the Middle East, particularly via Iran, where that there has been conflict in the immediate years after the Second World War. But when in 1956, the big crisis comes in which Britain and the French, and indeed Israel for that matter, think that their energy interests are being threatened by the nationalist regime, which is now in power in Egypt, and then the Suez Crisis moment coming in 1956, is you have the conflict play out, because the American position under President Eisenhower is to say, we don't back imperial powers. That's the old world. The new world,
we're the imperial,
the post-war
power.
World is one in which, yeah, either they're the imperial power, they don't really want to say that, or this is the world of nationalism. This is the world in which the age of European empire is over. But actually, what the British are doing in the Suez Crisis is exactly what the Americans have wanted them to do, because the Americans neither want to project military power in the Middle East themselves, nor do they want West European energy security to be threatened, either because that would mean an economic crisis in Europe that they don't really want to deal with, but also is the, commercially, the interests of their companies are at stake in the ability of West European states to import oil from the Middle East. So Eisenhower vetoes Anthony Eden's action, but he actually comes to regret that. And there are people in Washington who actually think that it's a long-term terrible mistake for Eisenhower to have stopped the British and the French acting against Nasser. But from the British point of view, that this is a really, it's both a seismic shock, but it's also the beginning of the story of retreat. It will take another 11 years to play out to the point of the Arab-Israeli War of 1967 and Nasser actually shutting the canal, this time for 8 years. And the British simultaneously being unable to cope with an insurgency, a communist insurgency in South Yemen. But the outcome of all those events in 1967 will be what comes to be called the retreat from east of Suez.
Yeah. Don't you think this is an interesting moment in that it's the interplay of like the grand geopolitics, but also of democratic politics or ideas that are sort of bubbling up the tongue? Because the crisis happened just before the American elections, I think, in the November. And he just doesn't feel like he can sort of give this the go-ahead in the run-up into the elections. And so that's partly why he vetoes it. In the same way that ideas of sort of nationalism are bubbling up at the time of the Ottoman collapse. And that is why you have these assertions of modernity that, you know, the Atatürk is Turkey is an assertion of, well, we're a modern European nation state as well. We belong with all the rest, and so you have these kind of ideas as well as geopolitics that are shaping things. And then I think that's important in Britain's case after Suez. I mean, I think it's surprising that there hasn't been a more of a kind of British Gaullism in response to Suez. Why wasn't there more visceral kind of anti-Americanism here, where, given that we've just been vetoed by the United States? Kind of, whether or not it changed anything, I think there is a reasonable argument to say that it didn't necessarily change the fundamentals of British power or Britain's economic health. But it was kind of humiliating for the political class. Whereas in France, they reacted against that by pushing for further European integration. In that sense, right, hang on, we've been screwed over here. Do not be so reliant on the Americans. And I think, isn't it Adenauer or somebody who says to the French, you know, your revenge. Europe will be your revenge. You know, we'll unite and we'll take back some kind of autonomy. Whereas our conclusion is never act without the Americans on foreign policy again, because you risk humiliation.
I think that that's true, but I think it's also the case that there's a clear difference between the British position and the French position in the Middle East at the time, is that Britain can still exercise some kind of, or at least it can have a military presence in the Middle East in the way in which the French can't. So the British get pushed out of Egypt as a result of the Suez Crisis. So Britain effectively regroups in Aden.
Yeah.
So that's present day
Yemen.
Southern Yemen. It's that crisis, as I said, in 1967 that will actually precipitate the retreat from the east of Suez that I think Dennis Healey announces when he's Harold Wilson's defence secretary in January of 1908. The British have got something to defend in the Middle East too, because that they have got a commercial presence via what is now the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, not just in Iran, but in Kuwait too. So Kuwait becomes actually a pretty important country to be supplying oil for Britain during the 1960s. And Britain, unlike other countries in Western Europe, is able to pay for that oil, particularly the oil that comes from Kuwait, in sterling.
Yeah.
It doesn't need dollars for it. And that's one of the reasons why in 1968, there's a connection between Wilson finally deciding that he has to devalue sterling as a currency and the retreat from east of Suez. Because once sterling is devalued as a currency, the notion of sterling oil, of being able to pay for that oil in sterling, kind of falls away, because who wants to receive their money for the oil that they're selling in a devalued currency? So I think that whilst both Britain and France are humiliated in 1956, if you look at it in terms of enduring interests in the Middle East and compare the British position and the French position, that they're not the same. I think we should, in getting on to where we want to get to, because we could spend a lot of time in the aftermath of Syria, just reiterate a thing that I think we've said a number of times over the last 6 months, what an important decade the 70s is in really ending this whole European imperial world in the Middle East that had emerged out of the First World War. And crucially, the United States, despite the fact that in the 1970s, it was on a trajectory to become very rapidly the world's largest oil importer and was going to need oil from the Middle East, was not in any shape or form able to replace British power there.
Yeah, so the story that we're trying to say is that, trying to tell is that up to sort of 67, 68, you have this uneasy compromise where, despite Suez, there is some kind of understanding that Britain will play a role upholding order in the Middle East. That starts to fall away in 68. And then so in the 70s, you have this problem, all who is going to control this region, or who does take overall responsibility? And there's obviously one answer there, which is the US. But what they want to do is to get somebody else to do it. And that is the Saudis or the Iranians.
Well, and I would say the Iranians.
And the Iranians. And so they're there too. And this is sort of this is always hard to get your sort of mind back into this world that existed at the time. But this is a world in which Iran and Israel are allies. And Israel is getting its oil from Iran. And it's pre-revolutionary Iran. And so these are the two proxies for asserting some kind of power. And that's why the Iranian Revolution is so kind of shocking and changes everything. It's not just that, what did Foucault call it? The first revolution against the West, or something like that. It's not just that the idea, again, I think that importance of the ideas that are emerging. It's not that the idea is different, but it's both the idea and the geopolitics at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it basically is, a crisis of the entire way in which the Americans have coped with the conjunction of British withdrawal coming in exactly the same time as their domestic oil production has peaked and they're on this path to becoming such a large oil importer, and the Vietnam War, which means they cannot think about essentially having more body bags coming back from war in another part of the world. At the same time,
feels quite reminiscent.
Is that the whole basis in that respect of American foreign policy, I'd say, from the end of Vietnam all the way perhaps to the aftermath of 9/11, is no more body bags. So if you're going to do things, either get other people to do it for you, whether that's the Mujahideen, whether that's actually Iraq against Iran in the 1980s, or do it from the air. And that means that the idea that they can use their power to try to order this part of the world is just a non-starter. And the interesting thing is, I think that is actually true, even when you have Jimmy Carter in January of 1980 articulating what on the surface is this incredibly important doctrine, the Carter Doctrine, which says essentially any external intervention in the Persian Gulf will be regarded as a direct threat to America's own interests. That would make you think that the Americans were going to be a lot more involved in projecting power in the Middle East. But I was a little bit surprised when I went back, and I think, can't remember which of the episodes that we were doing at the time, Tom, and looked at the actual naval deployments of the Americans through the entire post-war period. And the shift to moving more of the Navy to the Middle East doesn't come with the Carter Doctrine. It comes with the first Gulf War.
Yeah.
And that is then the interlude. That is the end, if you like, the end of the interlude. And from the first Gulf War to the world in which, not, I would say, that we live in now, because I think we've been through another juncture since, but at least, let's say, to some point in the middle of the 2010s, maybe when Obama is ordering the US back into Iraq to deal with ISIS, that you do have this American willingness for the first time to try to use military power to order the Middle East.
Sticking with the 70s for a second. So is one of the consequences of not doing it yourself, or perhaps they just can't, they're not powerful enough, and they've gone through this crisis in Vietnam, so they're just not willing as well to do it. But it empowers those countries in the Middle East themselves. Isn't this the kind of the story of 73 and the oil crisis of 73 that's kind of combined with the Yom Kippur War in 73? And that is partly an assertion of Arab strength at that time and has such enormous consequences here. You know, I think there's a reasonable argument that without the oil crisis, Heath might have won a second term, and that's potentially a transformative moment there. You know, you don't get Thatcher and all of those things. So is that what's going on? And the kind of the power, that power, external power of the Soviet Union just means that you can just have some kind of equilibrium at that time.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's equilibrium, but what I think is true is that in that moment that you're describing in 1973, Tom, is you can see a number of things come like really sharply into focus. The first of them is that now it's the oil-producing states in the Middle East, not the international oil companies, that are really calling the shots. It's not actually the case that the Saudi oil, the Saudi state controls all the oil in 1973, that the nationalization of the oil industry in Saudi Arabia comes a bit later in the decade. But it's clearly the case that it's the Saudi government that's making these decisions, and the international oil companies are just having to live with the decisions that the Saudis and the other Arab states are making. That's one like fundamental change. The second is that now for the first time that Saudi Arabia is really willing to back the radical Arab regimes like Egypt and Iraq effectively against Israel. That hadn't really been true even in the 1967 war. The Cold War is very much part of that crisis of 1973. Two, if you go back and look at the things that Nixon and Kissinger are worrying about in Washington, particularly Kissinger, because Nixon's kind of having a nervous breakdown at the time about Watergate, is that he's worried actually about nuclear war possibility over what's happening. So a big part of Kissinger's project is to push the Soviets out of the Middle East. And I think in some ways he regarded that as his great success in the 70s.
That's how to understand the Israel-Egypt deal, right, that happened. So after the Yom Kippur War, then you get the peace agreement. Is it 79 or 80, I think?
Yeah, 79.
79. And that is seen from, I mean, when I was reading back about this, I thought it was quite extraordinary that Israel is giving up control of oil fields that is taken in war. And what is it getting in return? It's getting in return recognition from Egypt. From the American perspective, that they're pushing the Israelis to do this because they want to draw Egypt out of the Soviet sphere of influence into a sort of more of a neutral place. But now you can see that it's a Western ally. How do they sort of effectively pay Israel to do that? They say, well, we'll guarantee your oil supply. And that is something that then runs through all the way to Obama. It continues all the way through. But that is, I mean, a big price that the Israelis have paid. And it's only understandable within that context of the Cold War. And the more I thought about it is, again, the first Gulf War then is only understandable with the collapse of the Cold War coming in, well, starts in 1990 effectively, doesn't it? And then to that, or early 1990, 1991. And so only with the collapse of that other external empire do you get the Americans finally going, well, we'll do the ordering with force.
And even then, I think that there's actually quite considerable reluctance. I think we talked about this in one of the episodes too. I think you were quoting Margaret Thatcher. Encouraging George Bush Sr. at one point, because the invasion, I think...
Not to go wobbly.
Yeah, I think the invasion happens of, so Iraq invading Kuwait happens, I think, in August of 1990, and the war to push Iraq out of Kuwait doesn't start until early 1991.
Yeah.
And as we know, is regardless of the rights and whatever we think about the rights and wrongs of that decision, there's a pretty clear judgment made by George Bush Sr. that the war's purpose is only to take Iraq out of Kuwait.
Yeah.
Now, in the end, there's also protection offered to the Kurds, but there's no willingness to use American force to overthrow the regime in Baghdad.
Yeah, but interestingly as well, we were sort of trying to draw some threads through from this moment. This is a moment then that you get a US base established in Saudi Arabia, I think for the first time. And then this will be a sort of a sore point, more than a sore point, that will in some ways explain or help explain the 9/11 attacks. This is one of the reasons that is given, I think, for the, you know, the American presence in the Holy Land. And it's in the second Gulf War in 2003, the Americans withdraw from that base. So they are completely linked. The two wars are only understandable together. And I think then it's the Americans pulling all the way back to Florida, right? That's where the base is now.
Well, they've never been able actually to establish central command in the Middle East itself because no Middle Eastern country was willing to have it. So central command was created as a product of the Carter Doctrine, but it was always been headquartered in Florida.
Yeah.
Because it's not been, the domestic politics in any of these Arab states has not made it possible to have that kind of American...
You almost see the same story, don't you, of Britain, what Britain's trying to do and how it sort of tries to assert control, finds it incredibly difficult, ends up withdrawing to the edge, to the coast and having bases there and trying to protect those bases there. And in Britain's case, effectively being pushed out of Aden because of guerrilla tactics to try to remove Britain. Something similar in Egypt, just finding it impossible once you've got to that. So it does make you kind of, depending on what your view is about whether Western forces should be there, but if you think about Western bases in the Middle East now, they're all along the coasts, aren't they? They're in Bahrain, in Kuwait, on the other side in the Horn of Africa. They're all along there. And you can kind of see history repeating itself.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that we should bear in mind is that there is an attempt to try in a way to solve that problem of why it's so difficult to have American military bases in an Arab country by, in the 90s, dealing with the Palestinian-Israel conflict. Because this is the decade under Bill Clinton in which the Americans are pushing very hard for a peace. And they are committed to a peace process. And I saw something, I think just the other day of Bill Clinton, like basically saying that it cost him everything, this peace that then failed. I think it makes sense to think about why the Americans were so committed to the peace process under Bill Clinton, because if they were going to be a permanent presence militarily in the Middle East, then they had to try and take the Israel-Palestinian question away, because that is what made it. If you're there for oil reasons, then having that as a running sore in your relations with Arab states, the oil-producing states, was very, very difficult. If you then move on to the second Gulf War, so the second Iraq War, we can see that the war not only goes horribly wrong from the American perspective in terms of leading not to a pro-Western regime in Iraq, but actually in the end, one that's in an Iranian sphere of influence and along the way, civil war. But actually, that whole question of how can the United States act as a military power in the Middle East whilst the Israel-Palestinian question is still going on is right there. And in a way, it sort of goes under the surface, I would say, between 2005 when Israel pulls out of Gaza until the 7th of October of last year. But now we're in a world in which all the American problems about exercising power in the Middle East is occurring simultaneously with the fact that the prospects of peace between Israel and Palestinian, Palestine at the moment, look non-existent.
Yeah, I mean, they're also even more connected than that in a way, aren't they? That there is a sort of reasonable case that the one way to understand October 7th is as an attempt to derail the American attempts to get back to a world of something like the 70s, 80s, where they're using, they're not able to assert control, but they're using allied proxies to do so, Saudi Arabia in this case. And so the Abraham Accords, to try to normalize relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, the great goal of those accords that seemed to be getting closer, this was an attempt to derail that, because it was an attempt to derail that wider geopolitical ambition to create some kind of newer order there. And then I think what we've been thinking about in these episodes that we've been recording, or trying to see it at least, is that if you had the collapse of the Soviet Union being necessary for the invasion, the first Gulf War, and then ultimately the second Gulf War, what you're seeing now is, for the first time, is other outside actors that aren't Western starting to come into the Middle East and asserting some of their control. So in the wake of the Syrian civil war and the civil war in Iraq, effectively, you've had Iran becoming a power in Iraq. You've had Turkey coming down into Syria to control Kurds and Libya, and across the Sahel, actually. We did an episode on Africa that was about that. And then, perhaps most importantly, Russia, who then came into Syria as well, established their own base in Syria. So if you think about the Carter Doctrine of 1980, and then you think about the world that exists today, where you have all of these outside actors that have it, seeing their influence grow, that's a completely different world. And then we haven't even got on to China. And then thinking about the crisis that we've got at the moment with the Houthis, or the Houthis, and thinking about if you ever get a chance to look at a map of all the military bases in that part of the world, it's absolutely extraordinary, because I think you've got Chinese have a base, is in Djibouti, I think, and then you've got the French have a base there as well. I think the Italians have one. We have one round the corner. The Americans have one. Oh, the Japanese have one as well. And so it seems to me that this is the story where we are today. For the start is the Ottoman Empire of an imperial power controlling that region, and then that collapses, and then you have the history that we've gone through. Today is a story of a mess where other non-Western powers are coming into that space.
Yeah, I think maybe just to bring this part towards an end anyway, because I'm sure we always say this and then we never quite get to an end, is I think that what we can see is that there's a whole set of dynamics that are being played out, if you like, on land. And central to that, I think, is the Syrian civil war, in terms of the spillover effects of that, the humanitarian disaster in Syria itself, the fact that that's what brought the Russians back into the Middle East. And if you think of that as a story from like the 1970s, Kissinger pushed the Soviets out in September 2015 in taking Russia into the Syrian civil war. Putin brought them back, and there was a base, the Tartarus base, that had been kept through that entire period without much happening there, and has been reactivated since that intervention. And even what appeared to be the relative success, and I speak very much just stressing relative there of taking ISIS out of Syria. Even that is back into question. Again, if you look at what's been happening in terms of ISIS attacks in Syria during the course of the last months. And I think you'd be hard pushed actually to say that even Russia, which on one side, on one hand, you could say asserted its military power relatively successfully in Syria from 2015, can't act as an ordering power there. The United States certainly can't. Then you've got the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. But if you then go and really sort of focus in on the Persian Gulf itself, the center of the Carter Doctrine, that's the one place the Americans haven't actually retreated from. But there's a kind of profound now irony there, because that's the one place where they're secure or relatively secure, and they've not actually found that the Houthis have been attacking in the Persian Gulf as opposed to the Red Sea since the 7th of October. But if you look at whose oil is being transported out of the Persian Gulf and who the biggest beneficiaries of that are, it's not the United States, obviously, it's China. So actually, you've now got this situation where the American Navy provides energy security for China.
But this is why that surely can't last. You know, you don't have to be a Trump supporter to think that doesn't sound sensible.
Well, I think that you could take a look at Trump himself, because if you go back to the summer of 2019. When the Houthis actually were attacking in the Persian Gulf, and they made a major attack on a very important Saudi oil facility, to which the Americans initially, so this is Trump as president, did nothing, did not respond, much to the absolute disbelief of the Saudi government. You've got Trump, I'm not sure he was tweeting exactly at that moment, but around that time, basically saying, look whose oil it is. It's 90% going to China and Japan. Why should we be doing this? But if you then go on to the beginning of January of 2020, so you go to January of 2020, is that Trump did do something about it, which was to order the assassination of General Soleimani.
Yeah.
And if you remember, beginning of that year, all the talk was about how Trump was so irresponsible. He was about to cause World War III for this. And it may well be the case that a president like Trump or someone in that space doesn't really like the idea of using the American Navy to protect Chinese oil imports. But the real question is does anybody in Washington want the Chinese Navy to be the dominant power in the Persian Gulf, protecting Chinese oil imports? Because that is certainly not what the Carter Doctrine. That would be to repudiate the Carter Doctrine. That would be to say that this era that began in the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution was over entirely. And I don't think we're there yet.
No, well, maybe we should leave it there. And it sounds like, in a way, that they're always trying to have their cake and eat it. They would like the power, but they would like not to necessarily have to use it.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The story that you told in the first half, the thing that I noticed is that the one thing that's lurking in the background in all the events that you told is the importance of oil. And it strikes me that we're living in a world now where all the major powers are competing to be the power that sort of moves us away from a world in which oil is as important as it was in the 20th century. And I just wondered how you saw that competition playing into the dynamics in the Middle East in the future. I appreciate, you know, we're a few decades off yet when we move away from water, and which oil is as important as it is now. But yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a very important question. And I think in a way, the most important answer is that nobody knows when that world is coming. And that is part, in a way, of the uncertainty in the Middle East. Now, I think that if we look at it realistically, then if we were talking about a world, and this may be quite optimistic, but we'll stick with this as an assumption for the moment, that uses about half the oil in 30 years' time that we use today. So that would be using about 50 million like barrels a day. I that may well be optimistic, but let's just say use it for the sake of argument. Then the question will be, well, in 30 years' time, which countries will be producing 50 million barrels of oil a day between them? Now, the answer isn't going to be that the United States is a significant part of that any longer, unless there are a whole set of new shale discoveries. Because the way things are going, that the US shale oil boom is going to play out sometime in the next decade, in the 2030s. It's quite possible that Russia will be a pretty significant player still, but that may depend upon whether Russia itself can develop the shale rocks that have oil there. And it's highly likely that the production at 50 million barrels a day in 30 years' time would come from Middle Eastern countries. And actually, if you looked at it in terms of the countries with large reserves in relation to existing production, the answers would probably be Iraq and Iran. The caveat, the one country that would also be true of that's not part of the Middle East is Venezuela. But Venezuelan oil is quite difficult for most countries' refineries to deal with because it's particularly thick. So I think that whilst the disruption to oil consumption will have a profound effect on the geopolitics of the Middle East, not least because it will make the position, I think, of Saudi Arabia particularly difficult unless the Saudis find new oil and develop that in the next decade. Also, it's not going to mean the end of the geopolitics of oil in the region, because someone will still have to be giving the world economy, as I say, that's a hypothetical figure, and the Middle East countries will be players, particularly, as I say, I think the ones that presently have underdeveloped oil.
That's a cheery picture for us all. I mean, I was thinking, as you're saying, this is a small plug, but when you said Venezuelan oil, we may do an episode next week on Guyana, which seems to have just discovered a whole load, and of which Venezuela seems to be eyeing up. So that may be one that will come out next week. I wanted to ask Helen, because I always find it completely fascinating when she gives that kind of picture. But when we've done episodes on France and nuclear power, it doesn't seem like actually the green world, even if it did come in, means that the geopolitics of energy goes anywhere, because they have to just go and look for those materials somewhere else. And batteries is another example of that.
It is. I mean, I think what is true thus far anyway, I mean, it could change, is that the Middle East isn't particularly important in terms of the metals that are required for the energy transition. Now, that isn't to say that will be the case forever. Generally, the metals that are most important for the energy transition are in the southern hemisphere. So far as we live in a world in which the geopolitics of fossil fuel energy coexists with the geopolitics of the energy transition, the Middle East is very much on the fossil fuel end of it and not on the metal end of it.
How does the most populous country in the world, India, sort of fit into this? So I know for most of the time we've been talking about they haven't really been a player, but I suppose it plays into the question about the energy transition and how India's politics might influence what we've been talking about.
I think on India, it's important to see that actually India has been a loser from the events of the 7th of October and its aftermath, because Israel's attempt to normalize relations with Saudi Arabia and generally the Abraham Accord states was bound up with a package of infrastructure and transportation, not just about energy, but about other trade route issues too, of which India was like very much a part. It was a Middle East, a sort of India, Middle East, Israel corridor into the Mediterranean. And if you think about one of the motivations in terms of Iran's moves in relation to the 7th of October and the Hamas attacks as being disrupting all that, then that is actually quite a big deal. And that if you look at it in terms of Pakistan's fit with all this, Pakistan and Iran pressures for building, I think it was a pipeline, certainly some kind of energy infrastructure between the two. So the fact that it's much more difficult for Israel to continue with the policy of normalization with certain Arab states does come at a cost, I think, from India's point of view.
Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate it. Keep listening and sharing it with all your friends and family.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.